I was hoping that we could start by taking things back to before you were writing a book or before you were a public presence, and just kind of go over the
Sure.
original story that led you towards becoming someone who's pretty well known for debunking conspiracy theories. Because I feel like, there's got to be a pretty significant backstory there from your perspective, because you dedicate so much time to it now. It's clearly important to you. So can you just walk us through the backstory of why you now do what you do?
Sure. Well, it's quite a long story, really. I mean,
That's
it
fine.
dates
You've
all the way
got time.
back to all the way back to my childhood, when I was just interested in this type of thing. I was big comics and science fiction fan when I was young, and that kind of continued throughout my whole life. I had an interest in science, but yeah, I think where it kind of took off was probably when I started reading a thing called the Unexplained magazine, which is an old British periodical, and it was basically all about kind of weird stuff, including UFOs, but other stuff. I mean, the one I specifically remember was like spontaneous human combustion. There was like ghosts and mind reading and telepathy and stuff like that. It was just kind of, I found the topic kind of interesting. I kind of segued more into more kind of like science based stuff, and I think I kind of learned to read on my dad's collection of like DC comics and Marvel comics that he had so, like in his room back in the 70s, I guess. Yeah, in the 70s. So that kind of like triggered my interest in science fiction and science, and did reasonably well at school, not like super well or anything. And then I kind of didn't do much with it for many, many years after I kind of went to college and into the games industry. I ended up doing video games for many years. Didn't really have much time to investigate things then. And then after I kind of like moved away from the games industry, moved more towards a writing career, I started writing about various topics that interested me. One of them was this disease called Morgellons, where people think that there's fibers coming out of their skin. Another one was chemtrails, because I was learning to fly at the time, which was another kind of an old goal of mine from as a child. I used to read, funnily enough, Jonathan Livingston Seagull by Richard Bach, which is Richard Bach has a whole series of books on flying, but one of them is the Jonathan Livingston Seagull thing, which I'm sure will amuse some people. But yeah, hey, I always loved the idea of flying. Started to learn to fly, got interested in chemtrails, started out kind of like on Wikipedia, like editing things on Wikipedia. This is back like 16, 17 years ago. Kind of got disillusioned with Wikipedia and moved on to doing my own blog, which is Contrail Science, all about chemtrails, and then moved on to doing a forum, which is a more collaborative blog, essentially. And that's Metabunk. And that's, I just did move from topic to topic for a while. Did a lot of Flat Earth for a while, partly because Joe Rogan wanted me to come on his show and talk about Flat Earth, so I had to do a little deep dive into Flat Earth before I did that. I kind of ended up with UFOs. I think it was like kind of a combination of my skill set. I'd know a lot about basic physics, basic 3D geometry, three dimensions, how to make a 3D scene appear in two dimensions on a screen, and vice versa. And the fun of investigating individual cases. I really like figuring out exactly what's going on. And with a lot of the UFO cases, there are cases where people haven't figured that out, or when it's a new case, people haven't figured it out. So I just kind of enjoyed that process. And really, that's why I do it. I do it because I enjoy the investigations. I enjoy the people as well, but it's mostly about figuring stuff out and doing the analysis and trying to get the right answer. I wouldn't say it's like important to me in other senses. I mean, it's kind of important in this what I do on a daily basis. It's because of a fun thing to do, and I'm kind of semi-retired now. But yeah, that's kind of how it all happened, and that's where I am now.
So was it always being taken from the position of trying to actually disprove the theory, or was there ever a time where you found yourself wrapped up in believing something, and maybe then there was a change of pace, or what happened for you?
It was always basically trying to figure out what the reality is. I don't go into something and say, I think this is wrong, I'm going to try to disprove it. I might go into something and say, this seems wrong, let's see, why is it wrong? Like, for example, the Morgellons thing. Like, you take Morgellons, you know, when you first hear about it, it's not immediately, you know, obviously wrong. These people thought that they had fibers on their skin, and there are some diseases that make your skin a little bit more fibrous. So, you know, it could be something like that. You know, the cellulose, whatever it is, kind of gets a bit stringy, or, you know, things can happen. So that, you know, it doesn't immediately sound like it's incorrect. So I've got to go in there and figure out what's actually going on. What are these people actually claiming? What is the evidence? What is the science? And what happens when you bring all those things together and you do an analysis of what's actually happening? And it turned out in that case, yeah, the vast majority of what was happening with people with Morgellons was that they had something else wrong with them, and that when they found fibers on their skin, it was kind of unrelated to their other issues.
Right.
And then with chemtrails, like, you know, you start out with a thing like, oh, the government is spraying poison from the sky. Sounds ridiculous. So you go into it and say like, is it ridiculous? Like, what's the actual evidence again? You know, what are people claiming is happening? And what is the evidence that they use to support it? And then what is the science that we can use to analyze that evidence? And, yeah, math and science and geometry, as well as just regular science like chemistry and physics. And then again, with UFOs, even more so, it's about trying to figure out what's actually happening. Because with any individual case, you don't go to it and say, you know, someone says, I saw a light in the sky. You don't say, oh, you're a crazy person because you saw a light in the sky. I see lights in the sky. It's a perfectly normal thing. And you could see something that seemed amazing as well. I've seen things that on first glance seemed like they were amazing and turned out that they weren't later. So I can readily see how people might see something that they initially thought was amazing. And then there's always the chance that it might actually be something that actually is amazing, and that would be really awesome to discover. That's always kind of like in the back of my mind, like, you know, what if these cases were actually real? But yeah, good to your question, I haven't really found one that's given me pause and thought, like, you know, this seems like it's something. Obviously, you think, like, what if this is true? Then, yeah, that would be pretty amazing. But the evidence, as you know, in ufology is generally, you know, not always ideal.
Yeah, but I would say that some might argue that with a platform like Metabunk, obviously the incentive is to actually disprove the case. That is essentially the modus operandi.
No, I would disagree with that, because what Metabunk is about is being right, which sounds like, you know, you got to be right or at all costs, but it's not that way. It's about finding what is the right answer. And so if the right answer is that there are actually like non-human intelligence craft flying around in the sky, that is what the methodology that we use should hone in on, because the facts should eventually point to that. So the motive for me when doing things on Metabunk or anywhere else is to try to get the most accurate answer, and not necessarily one that fits a particular narrative.
Do you have examples of cases, not necessarily within the specific category of non-human intelligence or like intelligently controlled vehicles, because that's a very specific thing that can kind of quite easily be said, well, we don't have definitive evidence for that. But do you have cases on Metabunk that you have pinned as this is still, quite frankly, unexplainable?
Well, there are many cases that are unresolved.
Right.
But inexplainable, you know, it's kind of a complex word. Like, what does it mean for something to be inexplainable? Is it inexplainable?
Currently not explainable because you don't have an explanation for it.
Yes, but that's, you know, it's a circular definition, really. Like, what you're saying is it's inexplainable for certain reasons. Like, yeah, the reasons could be a couple of things. It could be that we don't have enough information about the case, that it's something like, you know, it was an optical illusion, and yeah, all we have is an eyewitness account, and so we're not getting the accurate things. Or it could be something like, you know, it's a visual, an actual, you know, real event that someone's photographed, but you're missing things like how far away is this object, or what actually is it, because it's too blurry. Or it could be unexplainable because we have something that's actually doing something, like demonstrably doing something, that is beyond what we understand in terms of technology and science, and perhaps even, you know, physics in general. And these are all kind of different things. And really, the cases that I've seen that are inexplainable fall into the category of being inexplainable because we don't have enough information. I don't think there's a good case where we can definitively say, you know, this is unambiguously doing something that defies our conventional technology. There are certainly cases where it might appear to be doing something. Like if you see something like a, you know, light in the sky and it goes zip, zip, that's like a light appearing to make a certain maneuver that, you know, breaks the laws of physics, essentially. If you interpret that as being a craft at a certain distance, then if you interpret it as being something closer, it you know, could be an insect or something. But we don't know because, you know, we see these videos of lights in the sky and we don't know how far away the object is. Well, I mean, so, yeah, there are inexplicable things.
I mean, there are some pretty good night optics of the stars moving, like, you know, satellites tracking and things like this. And then you'll see, like, an obscure movement and a trace away from, you know, its trajectory and things like this. But to be honest, like, for me, it's not... You know, rather than focusing on case-by-case attempts to either prove or disprove, because I also see glaring issues with certain cases that are put forward and highlighted, you know, I kind of prefer to look at the large numbers, at the length of timelines, and when it comes to anomalies, just in general, kind of being reported, either behaving strangely in the air or interacting on the ground, whether it's orbs of light or metallic objects or the presence of beings that seem otherworldly. You know, they're... These are phenomena that have been reported globally across almost every single culture, if not every single culture, through their own lens of perceiving it, since almost pretty much the dawn of human civilization as we know it. So I just kind of struggle to see how every unexplainable instance throughout history can be firmly brought into focus by the current status quo of scientific modernity, because why should it?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, what we're talking there is about the weight of evidence. Like, you got a lot of evidence, and you could argue, and people do argue, that because there's so much evidence, some of it has to be, you know, a genuine anomaly. And, you know, maybe it is, but do we know which ones are the genuine anomalies and which ones are not? Yeah, you know, all we know is that we have a lot of evidence. Some of it is similar, but, you know, we also have similar things from mythology across cultures. That, you know, just this kind of convergent evolution, essentially, of stories. You know, we have myths that go back about certain animals, like dragons, for example, that exist in other cultures. We have giants and things like that, for which we don't have any good physical evidence of. But we have lots and lots of stories.
Smithsonian somewhere, maybe they've got the giant bones.
Well, possibly, yes. But you could argue that about anything. That's the hidden evidence argument of any type of alternative thing, like ufology included. And there's the whole jokes about the trust me, bro, approach to ufology.
Absolutely.
But, you know, we look at the actual evidence. Sure, we've got like this historical record of all these accounts. And I can see how that's very compelling, and I know a lot of people are compelled by it. But I think, you know, the most people who are very compelled by ufology are people who have actually had their own experience.
Yeah,
and that's that is something that's very difficult to address, because if someone has had an experience that, you know, to them seems incredibly real, there's only a couple of possibilities, really. You know, it's either it was real, like, and that it represented like a real object, or it was like a kind of a real thing that was misinterpreted, or it was something, you know, more like misremembered or something like that. But, you know, the first one of those is satisfactory to the person who was there, and they are the only person who was actually at that event, and so they're the only ones who can actually say from their perspective whether an explanation works or not. And generally, they've rejected, or they've considered and rejected, like, lots of alternative things, like, you know, was it a bird? Was it a plane? No, it wasn't, because I know what I saw. But for everybody else, this leads us into this kind of dilemma and this kind of situation that where we're at in ufology, in that we've got all these people saying these things, but we don't have the physical evidence to back it up.
But does that mean that therefore there is nothing evidential of it, or that it exists within some form of realm that physicality.
Yeah, to I mean, that's where you go, isn't it? That's where you have to go with that. And that's kind of like where Jacques Vallée goes.
Yeah.
You know, he's someone who's, you know, he's put forward as being like a scientist who investigates UFOs. But yeah, a lot of what he does is very much about interviewing witnesses and then basically believing that they had a valid experience, you know, which is fair enough. You know, you believe witnesses. You know, I generally believe that most witnesses, the vast majority of all witnesses, are being entirely honest when they give their accounts. Very few people, you know, make stuff up. Some people do, but, you know, most people that we see are being honest. But Jacques Vallée is, you know, he takes that, and I think he takes it to a bit of an extreme because he believes absolutely everything that people tell him. And so he has to come up with these very convoluted explanations to try to make sense of it. And then what he's come up with is kind of like, you know, interdimensional trickster beings that kind of project reality onto individuals' mind that varies by individual, which is kind of like a get out of jail free explanation. It just basically explains everything whilst explaining nothing. But I think the reality is perhaps a bit more, you know, I wouldn't say complicated than that, because it's that's a very complicated explanation. But I think there's a bit more variety in what people perceive, and a lot of what people perceive is actually misperceptions. And I would be open to the possibility of, you know, some of those accounts being genuine anomalies, but unfortunately, we don't have the evidence.
Yeah, unfortunately. I'm an experiencer as well. I've had a series of experiences that drastically changed the trajectory of my life. I was not doing this. I was a rock climbing instructor. I did, you know, different types of things in my life. I had no intention and no idea of going towards this type of subject. And I didn't even have, you know, a background interest in ufology. I just had a series of events that led to a series of events. And the things that I saw, I don't feel like I can rationally explain away.
Yeah.
And so that sent me on my own kind of, you know, journey into trying to understand this. But I mean, I agree with you that there's such a vast amount of misidentification. There's also a lot of, I would say, and there's evidence of it, intelligence disinformation to kind of muddy the waters for whatever reason, maybe their own classified projects, whatever they're trying to do. And they're using this as a smokescreen, as a cover. And there's, you know, a lot of evidence of generational kind of, you know, disinformation sown into conferences, into the circuits, into the conversations. So, like, you know, sifting through the minutiae of this to find anything that's actionable is extremely difficult. But my own bias, unfortunately, as someone who has seen something that they believe is beyond the scope of explainability right now, I have to say, right, well, I'm open to the interpretation that people have actually seen what they're claiming to see. And I think it's important to have that whilst operating a level of skepticism. But I think there's a danger from both sides of the polarity. If you're a hardcore believer and, like, you know, you're just like, any information that comes out, I'm ready to absorb it. And I just kind of totally think this could be real and I'm going to push it out there. But then on the other side, you have skeptics who are extremely knee-jerk reaction and quite narrow-minded in their corridor. And so I think bias exists on both sides. And there is likely a middle ground where there is actually a bit of a mystery going on, because life is very mysterious and we just have a little thimble of what's out there, you know, available to us on our little scientific architecture that we've erected since the Renaissance period. So, I mean, you know, I don't know if we're really fully there yet in explaining all of life's mysteries.
Yeah, I think, like, obviously we're not, but, you know, science is pretty good at, you know, explaining physics and everything, but there are, you know, there's things that we haven't discovered yet. But, like, with the two sides point of view, like, yeah, I agree that there are certainly extremes on the other side. There are people who are just, like, you know, regard ufology as being a ridiculous pseudoscience, and there are those people who basically believe everything. And you see those when they get into groups of people. I'm sure you're a member of a variety of Facebook groups, I'm sure, and some of those
don't even interact with the noise.
Yeah, but, you know, if you look at some of them, it varies quite a lot, but some of them are basically echo chambers where people will say things and they're accepted uncritically. You'll see something that's obviously like a lens flare, and you'll get like 30 people saying, you know, it's like, you know, it's a spirit of an angel or something like that. And maybe one or two people will crop up and say it's a lens flare, but you'll get it's very much a community, I think, where people are supportive of each other. But being supportive kind of tends into basically agreeing with them all the time. And you get, you know, similar things, but not quite the same in the skeptic community, where people are.
I'd say it's identical, Mick. I'd say it's almost.
Well, I would say it's different in that with the kind of the experiencer community, these are people who have had experiences. And I think that's a very different type of thing from people who haven't had experiences and are skeptical. It's not like, you know, you've had a revelation by nothing happening to you. You know, you having an experience is very different from me not having an experience. So it's a difference. It's a difference. It's similar in its kind of extremeness in the way people approach the subject, but it's not like, you know, someone's trying to validate their own experience. And I don't mean that in a bad way. Like, people try to validate their own experience because they believe it to be true.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think the, like, kind of ideological reinforcement is similar on both sides. Like, I really want to believe this is true versus I really do not believe this is true. And both of those produce a bias symptom.
Right, but like, I think one side, you know, I'm probably getting a little bit semantic here, but one side has this thing that they want to be true, and the other side just thinks that it isn't. It's not like we really have like a big desire. Why would I desire it not to be true? Most people who are skeptics, I think, would love for aliens to be visiting us. They think it'd be a really interesting thing to happen, and it would be really a great driver for science and technology. I'd love for these recovered alien craft to be real, because the potential for advancement of science will be great. And if it is real, then that represents some kind of cover up that should be exposed. So this isn't something that I don't want to be real. You know, it would be great if it was real. And I think most skeptics would agree it would be great. But they just think, and some of them very dogmatically, that it's impossible for aliens to be here because of, you know, the vastness of the universe and their current understanding of physics, which you could rightly say is a somewhat narrow-minded point of view.
Pick your brains on that real quick. I mean, I'm sure you would acknowledge the fact that there's like potentially novel forms of propulsion that completely dismiss space-time.
Well, potentially, yes. Potentially. Yeah, but I think, you know, people like Avi Loeb are, you know, even though Avi Loeb is somewhat of a believer, I think he thinks that you have to go by the laws of physics as we understand them. And he's said that, I think, and that's made a few people mad at him.
Yeah.
Like, he said that if things were actually moving at this incredible rate in the atmosphere, then you would see these plasma flares as, you know, the atmosphere gets compressed. You know, so things like the Nimitz encounter, where there are reports of things moving at 20,000 miles per hour, that is something that, you know, would have created basically bolts of lightning, essentially, kind of what it would look like as the thing moved through the atmosphere. But, you know, a lot of other people have also argued that perhaps it's a novel form of propulsion, that it's bending space and time and doesn't actually interact with matter. But Avi Loeb, being a somewhat mainstream scientist, says you kind of had to stick with the science.
Yeah.
But I think it's a valid thing to posit that there might be something novel, a new science, new form of technology. But again, I think you have to go with what is the evidence for that actually happening.
Yeah, but it is a bit of a rock and a hard place, because if it is non-traditional methods that are being deployed using traditional forms of scientific intrigue and not going to hold up to the actual weight of the situation. So, I mean, I agree that you have to approach it scientifically.
Yeah.
I think Avi Loeb, and I've interviewed Avi Loeb, he's a good guy and he's extremely, you know, like, energized on the subject, but I do think he is quite a traditional thinker in terms of his particular corridor through science. And I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing when addressing something that could be on the fringes of our ability to understand it.
Yeah, no, I agree in spirit. I think you know, we need to not have science fixed. You know, we need to have the possibility that there are things to discover and that there are things that we observe that might be better explained in different ways, because science has progressed. You know, it progresses every year. It's more perhaps incremental now. We don't get these big revolutions in science, but there are things coming along, like, you know, quantum technology is something that's relatively new, and it's something that's, you know, a burgeoning thing. There's artificial intelligence and the acceleration that might provide to things like quantum technology, and you know, who knows, we might have a quantum drive in a few years, not a few years, like a few decades. But I know what you're saying. Like, you know, we don't know everything about the universe. We know a lot about the universe, and we know what we can observe. So other things could be going on that we don't understand, but you really have to bound these speculations in some kind of evidence. Otherwise, it's just basically you're just making stuff up. You're just imagining things, that anything goes type of thing. You could say, what if it's a simulation? What if it's beings from another dimension? What if it's angels? What if it's humans from the future? What if it's like intraterrestrials from inside the Earth, or it's plasma beings who exist on a slightly different plane of reality? All these things, you can't disprove them. But is there actually evidence that points in that direction?
Yeah, I agree with you, Mick. And again, I feel it's a rock and a hard place, once again, coming from at least the experience or perspective of this, because it's inherently a subjective thing, especially if you don't, collect any data on it, like a video. And I'll be honest, I was so awestricken by what I was witnessing. The idea of looking down and picking my phone up out of my pocket was not even surfacing as a thought. I was just staring at what I saw. But either way, this kind of subjective nature to the experience, to the phenomena itself, if we're considering that there is a phenomena at play that seems to operate subjectively within, different people's experiences in different ways, different events, different anomalies, but the same type of invocation of a mystery, invocation of an unknown, when you actually have this type of experience, it's difficult because, science has to try and not throw the baby out with the bathwater when it comes to subjectivity, because that's our anchor into reality. I mean, we can talk about formula and mathematics and all of these complex ideas, but ultimately, what is it that makes you smile? Your child in the morning, or love and happiness and memories and good times. And these are the things that anchor us into reality, right? It's subjectivity. And it's this amorphous thing. We can't fully articulate it. We can't fully explain it. But consciousness itself is it. Like, it's the only thing that allows anything to be a thing. And so when people have, at least subjectively, profoundly life-changing and life-altering experiences, that even if you don't see evidence for the actual event, you see evidence for how it's changed that person, I think we have to consider some level of, of reality to that, but it's extremely difficult to prove because it doesn't it doesn't seem to operate in the same rules as
theory. Well, I mean, the problem there is how do you mesh your own subjective perception of reality with reality itself? And we could be just living in a dream right now. Like, I could be imagining talking to you, but the way you do that is to try to get external validation of what you are perceiving. Obviously everything is coming in through your own senses, so you could be a brain in the jar, but you can discuss with other people like what their experiences are, and you can see that there seem to be multiple brains in jars, and then you can see that we're experiencing a reality. When you let go of something, it always drops. It's very consistent, and the same thing happens for different people. So we can start measuring things about the universe that we can kind of agree upon as being this shared objective reality. And so we can mesh our subjective experiences with objective reality. But when we come to things like UFO experiences, that's where we have a bit of a disconnect, in that we get things that are just subjective. It's one person's individual experience, and we don't get a kind of external validation from some kind of measurable science. You do get the other kind of multiple brains in the jar validation, and that other people have similar experiences, but again, they're not measurable experiences. So it's difficult for people who think of reality as being this objective, measurable thing to interpret reality through a number of people's subjective experiences, which don't have a corresponding metric, some kind of measurement that actually validates those things. So it's not a problem that can be easily resolved, but it's something that we can talk about, and we can get a better feel for it. But I think it's going to keep being a problem for the indefinite future.
Once again, I agree. I think one of the kind of ways in which someone could maybe envision how these strange behaviors may operate in subjective experience, whilst we're all on this, relatively what we consider normal consensus terrain of physical, reality. I mean, if you scale up far enough or you scale down far enough, things get weird, man. Like, you know, you're on the cosmological scales with gravitational pull and time being bent and the fabric of space being bent down to the quantum levels where you have particle, everything that is responsible for what we are and what is around us down on that quantum level. Even though everything's acting linear in this realm, if I drop a penny, it falls to the ground with consistency, like you said. But inside that penny, the protons and electrons can exist in two places at once, can be doing all sorts of strange dances. And so for me, it's kind of like, well, there's some good evidence right there. So we're operating on this very fine band of normal. But underneath that normal, which is creating the normal, very abnormal, further up, still abnormal. So we're just on this little fine line. Mm-hmm. And the way that I see it is, who knows, maybe things can come in and out of our little fine strand of reality. And proving that would probably prove to be pretty difficult, man.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's two things there, though. There's proving, like, this kind of underlying weird substrate of the universe is capable of doing these weird things, which would be a great scientific discovery if
you know
that
quantum superposition and entanglement and, like,
sure, yeah. But I'm talking about how that would lead to things like the more subjective type experiences that we're talking about, like, you know, seeing giant flying craft
and the idea of, like, macro quantum effect. So instead of a micro quantum effect, which we're now actually starting to see demonstrable even in our current time with physics, is that macro quantum, like, scaling of quantum effects is possible given sufficient technology. And so that's a potential explanation for how, I mean, imagine if you could develop a technology that behaves in some way like an electron. I mean, you're gonna have a hard time chasing that on a Kodak.
Sure, yeah. I don't think that, I'm not sure that the physics as we understand it really supports that kind of extrapolation.
Certainly not.
We talk about, like, you know, quantum teleportation, and it's not really what people think. It's not Star Trek style teleportation.
No.
That's
the thing. Scalability, mate. Scalability, future.
Yeah.
You know,
but it's kind of interesting. You're talking about the quantum realm and the metagalactic realms, and because those are things that are also, in a way, like, they're purely objective, because no one really has any subjective experience with those things. It's like this abstraction. We don't really know if it's real or not, because it's, in some ways, it's just mathematical models. We can see things that are happening, but that we see them in a weird way, like these super colliders and these gravitational lensing and things like that.
That's almost doesn't really make much sense to people. That's almost like ufology. You're taking on a degree of faith based on, you know, relatively loose data sets that this is real, and most people.
But they are repeatable and measurable, though. If you do the same experiment twice with these things, or the same observation of something celestial, you'll get the same result. And that's something that, unfortunately, in ufology, we don't have this repeatable data.
I agree.
Don't know if you remember with Michio Kaku. He said once that now, you know, the burden of truth has shifted to some point. But what he was talking about there more broadly was that we have these videos, and videos are repeatable, testable data, because we can do, you know, analysis of the videos. But, you know, really, we have very little of that. And the vast majority of the evidence that we have for ufology is not repeatable. We have these individual one-time events that happen to people like you and various other people, that you can't really do very much with, other than perhaps do a little bit of general statistical analysis about, like, trends and things like that. But you can't go in there and do the math on what you saw. Whereas you can do that with this video, but, you know, this video is generally not very good either. So we still have this big dearth of evidence in that subjective realm, that we don't have that when we're talking about, like, quantum superposition, because we can do verifiable experiments that will repeat those things. So they're not really the same thing.
Well, no, it's extremely difficult. It's non-repeatable, as you said, and therein lies the major crux of this problem. I do think that still the overwhelming amount of kind of just testimony throughout history towards anomalous events that still seem to be reflected in modern testimony today speaks towards something that does need to be examined and can't be readily dismissed, because it's present and forever haunting humanity. It's still, I mean, let's get into the modern stuff. Why do you think all this attention's being given to UFOs by the government? I mean, the official statements of behavior, you know, anomalous capabilities and beyond next generation type of things. What explains...
Yeah, I know, I got some thoughts on that. I mean...
But also the decades of classified study prior to it, you know, because, I mean, it didn't start in 2017. This is just kind of a new discussion about it. So kind of a two-parter. Why the modern conversation, but also why the decades of, you know, classified study?
Well, I think the modern conversation in some ways is a bit of a backlash to the suppression, for want of a better word, of the topic before now. I think there has been a stigma in ufology, you know, about ufology, that has either naturally arisen or perhaps has been promoted to some degree. But, you know, it was certainly there. You know, if you think back to, you know, say before 2017, the media didn't take UFOs very seriously, and they still generally don't. That's changing. But, you know, the government themselves didn't really take things very seriously. If people reported UFOs, they were generally ignored, and they weren't taken seriously. You think back to, you know, what was the FAA's reporting procedure for UFOs? For a while, they didn't really have one, and then they somewhat bizarrely they changed to basically, you know, call Robert Bigelow, call Bigelow Aerospace, and this was actually in the FAA handbook. In, you know, the FAR AIMS handbook, where, you know, they said, like, you know, if you see a UFO, report it to a civilian agency, and here's a phone number to call. And they gave you the number of Bigelow Aerospace, which was a very weird thing. I mean, it showed that the government wasn't taking things seriously. But the problem with that is that there is actually an issue with UFOs. UFOs are real in that pilots see things in the sky that they can't identify. And just blowing it off isn't doing anyone any favors. And this is something that's increasingly become an issue, especially in the military realm, when we have more types of kind of alternative aerial platforms, you know, specifically various types of drones, but also balloons, you know, with the Chinese spy balloon and things like that, that are increasingly like national security threats that might have been reported as UFOs, but because of the stigma that we used to have and still have to some degree, these things were, you know, slipping under the radar, sometimes literally. And I think that partly what the response has been is a reaction to that. You know, we need to actually pay attention to these things. But also partly it's a reaction, a result of this long-term kind of essentially lobbying by various interests. You know, people like Robert Bigelow essentially is, you know, at the center of this, and Jack Vallée, and Harry Reid, and George Knapp, and there's all these people in the Las Vegas area, then Skinwalker Ranch, and, you know, Harry Reid got convinced with Lukatsky and Combe Kelleher, all these people, you know, they get convinced that something weird is going on and it needs to be investigated, and so they promote this investigation, and that's how the ball gets rolling. You know, and Elizondo, yeah, he wasn't a UFO guy. He comes on board and becomes a UFO guy, and then that leads to the New York Times story and the release of that information, and then more legislation, more lobbying, more media attention, and it's this kind of snowball effect, and everything is kind of bubbling to the surface now. Things that were suppressed before for whatever reason, perhaps because people thought it was silly, perhaps they're just covering up something else, perhaps they're covering up aliens. We don't really know. It's all kind of bubbling to the surface, which I think is great. I think, you know, the more sunlight we get on this topic, the better. I want to know what David Grush is talking about. You know, I want to know, like, what Carl Nell is talking about, and these other people. What are these bodies that Anna Paulina Luna mentioned the other day? You know, we need to know what's actually going on here, one way or the other, or multiple ways if there's lots of different things going on. So I think it's a culmination of a large number of things, and it's kind of coming to a head.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a group, you know, like a concerted network. And I think over the last couple of years of new players stepping in to the kind of government insider network that's looking to push transparency, we start realizing, oh, actually, they knew each other for 2 years, 3 years back. And, you know, they've all known each other for quite some time. That doesn't mean necessarily suspicious. I mean, you know, if you're in government or in military or in intelligence and you have an interest in the UFO thing, then going to become a little network of people that are interested in that particular facet. But, you know, you've had, you know, the Pentagon, ODNI, a lot of different official agencies releasing statements about, you know, like the Nimitz event and things like this. So, I mean, I know that you, because this is the thing, I didn't want to get into, like, you know, specifics like the Nimitz, because you've talked ad nauseum about that. And, like, you know, people know where you sit. But at the same time, can it all just be smoke and mirrors? I mean, like, you know, how do you have, like, you know, multiple sensors failing, pilot misidentification, like, you know, tracking misidentification all at the same time? And not just that, but, you know, they're not the only pilots and military witnesses. It goes decades, man. Like, there's got to be, at some point, you've got to be like, there's at least one of these that's, you know, strange. Because how are they hallucinating?
Right.
Crazy, or they're not trained properly. Like,
yeah. Well, in the same, it's almost similar to the issue of the experiences. You know, a lot of these reports are, you know, individual pilot reports, and you kind of expect pilots to be more scientific and everything than your average person, but you know, they're subject to the same illusions that other people are subject to. And this is something that's come out of Arrow's investigation. I know not everybody likes Arrow, but, you know, that a lot of the stuff they look at is going to be stuff that ends up being mundane. And they said a lot of the stuff that pilots are seeing boils down essentially to parallax illusions, where, you know, they're moving fast, there's something else moving or floating in the air, and it gives the illusion that this thing is moving. It's like the Baghdad sphere thing. I think it was Baghdad. It was the Middle East sphere case is one of the ones that they have on their site. And that's something where the apparent motion of the object is, you know, it comes from the drone moving, even though it doesn't look like the drone's moving because the camera's fixed. So there's this whole set of illusions that, you know, pilots are susceptible to. But we can't say for sure that each individual case is explainable. But we do know that when cases do get kind of resolved into something more definitive, they tend to get resolved into things like, you know, unfortunately, balloons and birds and other planes and flares and even stars and things like that. So it's not something I think you can rule out, that it might all be mundane. I don't think you can rule out that there's a possibility that there's something really interesting going on. And if you look at individual cases like Gimbal, you know, you didn't really want to talk about it, but like, it's come up recently, like, you know, Marek von Rennenkampf has made this long list of things that would have to go wrong. And this is a common, you know, technique that people do when they're trying to make an argument, but it's really not that complicated. You kind of list a whole bunch of things that need to happen in sequence, but, you know, perhaps a couple of malfunctions and someone making a mistake.
But don't you think
is that impossible, though?
Is that taking Occam's razor and stretching it out a little bit?
No, it's not. I mean, this is something I discussed with Marek about, you know, what Occam's razor actually is. I mean, Occam's razor isn't, you know, making the simplest explanation. It's the simplest explanation could be just, you know, oh, it's an alien craft. You got some kind of smoke coming up to your window there.
Oh, so. No, don't worry. That's
I'm just thinking you're not on fire.
That is just the heater thing kicking out, and it's quite cold outside.
Right, yeah, I get it. Yeah, sorry.
I appreciate the early warning, though. I would have been completely ignorant to that.
So, yes. Occam's razor isn't about, like, really making the simplest sounding explanation, because you could just say, oh, it's an alien spaceship, and that sounds very simple. I mean, you could say, oh, well, then this pilot had to, you know, coincidentally have, like, you know, two different equipment failures and also make a mistake, and then another pilot has to see something later that's, you know, something similar. You know, what are the odds of that? Yeah, does that, is it's an alien spaceship better satisfy Occam's razor than these other things? Well, you know, really, no, it doesn't, because Occam's razor isn't about the simplest sounding explanation. It's about the explanation that introduces the fewest new things into our universe, essentially. So if you got to kind of, like, you know, posit an alien civilization existing for your explanation to be correct, then that's really much, much more complicated, an entire alien civilization, than simply, like, you know, pilot making three different mistakes at the same time. It's kind of a misapplication of Occam's razor.
I don't know if it is a misapplication of Occam's razor, because, you know, there's a lot of compounding errors that would need to, you know, take place in multiple domains at once, which has got a pretty high probability ratio to it on its own. So, I mean, that in of itself is a pretty loosely you know, held together argument, because it's very unlikely that all of these things in, you know, from human intelligence to electronic intelligence would be failing simultaneously. But, you know, you don't have to invoke alien species. I think that's the issue, is that we're invoking alien species, alien civilization, and that does require a pretty, you know, big leap. But
well, if you don't, though, you're invoking something else.
There's classified projects, there's prototypes, there's advancements in human technology, there's unexplained exotic natural phenomena like piezoelectric ball lightning. And, you know, there are things that don't necessarily negate an exotic explanation.
But they're all new. They're all novel things that you have to introduce. You can't say this matches something that we know to exist.
Okay, I mean, how many good examples do we have of that level of kind of like sensor malfunction, human error, pilot error happening simultaneously?
Well, I mean, people do make very significant errors. Like pilots sometimes fly into mountains.
Do we have a testable example of such a huge...
A testable example? We have historical examples of things that went terribly, terribly wrong, like vastly more wrong than in these cases. I mean, for example, a Navy destroyer shot down an Iranian civilian airliner by mistake. So for that to happen, there had to be a cascading series of failures, which were catastrophic. You know, the worst kind of possible thing, like over 100 civilians died because the US Navy made these terrible series of errors. And some of that, I think, was possibly equipment, not exactly failure, but like not handling the failures adequately, like inadequate procedures. But yeah, things do happen. They're very rare. I mean, that was like 30-something years ago, I think. So they don't happen very often. But the ones that do happen are the ones that get remembered. Okay. This is how we get like these great UFO cases, is when something happens that is very unlikely. You know, something that, you know, doesn't happen every day. You know, people say like, well, if it was just a glare, why wouldn't people see it every day? Well, if people saw it every day, then they'd recognize it for what it was. So this is obviously something that doesn't happen every day, and that's why it becomes a UFO. So it's this kind of like almost like a filter. You know, you get billions of things happen every day. The vast majority of those are mundane, so perhaps like 1,000 of them are extraordinary. And sometimes one in those 1,000 things happens at the same time as another thing, and it becomes super extraordinary. And that becomes that once in a year or once in a decade thing that just happens because of some kind of weird coincidence. And that becomes the most amazing case. And then people will say, well, that couldn't possibly have happened. It's so unlikely. But someone's got to win the lottery. The person who wins the lottery, it seems amazing to them, but it's inevitable that amazing things happen. And those amazing things are going to be the amazing UFO cases.
Yeah, but I mean, don't you feel like the ratio is off? Like if it's about...
Not really, no. How many gimbals do we have?
Well,
how many gimbal videos do we have?
It's not just gimbal videos, but like just in terms of pilot military testimony and also civilian testimony, civilian pilot testimony. I mean, like there's just so much of it for years and years and years. So there's a kind of outweighing of rare event probability versus the compounding of information claiming a rare event's taking place. So like
the only ones,
how do we balance
the only ones
that?
We really hear about, though, are the ones where we get this extra data. If you get like
put in front of us, yeah, but there's tons. We know this, that you've gone through the historical records, even if you don't necessarily agree with it.
Right, but the vast majority of those are not things with very good supporting data. There are basically eyewitness accounts, which
An overwhelming level of them, you have to start defaulting towards a bias of skepticism to completely ignore that.
No, I wouldn't ignore the commonalities that we have in these accounts. And I think, you know, if you are investigating things like eyewitness accounts and the historical records, you have to, you know, try to see what are the commonalities. But then, you know, you got to think like, what are the reasons for those commonalities? Is it something that there's a physical reason, like people are seeing, like say the Foo Fighters, were they plasma balls that just occurred because of the very unusual types of flight paths that they use in wartime? And the technology of the time, like, you know, the engines that they use at the time, perhaps, I don't know, like, or the material of the wings or something like that was causing it. Is, you know, there's a commonality there, but what is the cause? You know, is the cause something that we can't explain, or is it something we can hypothesize about? You know, and then, you know, with the other events, like people see black triangles is a common, like, sighting. People, and they often describe them as being football field size. Black triangles, you know, the ones where we actually get video of these things, they often resolve to be things that are not actually black triangles, like they're three stars in a certain position, or it's a DC-9 which has three white lights in, on its the wings and the nose, or the wings and the tail. It looks like a triangle anyway. It's a very, very compelling illusion. So yeah, I think, you know, these commonalities can sometimes have mundane explanations, but, you know, then there's a whole bunch of things which we can't, and you end up being more speculative. Like, is it something that's to a degree like a, you know, visual illusion, something to do with the way the visual cortex works? There's things called the forms similar, which people under taking drugs will experience, where they're actually seeing geometric shapes that are representations of the internal structure of their brains. And, you know, maybe there's something that happens with people occasionally that results in certain types of similar visual illusions. You know, there's a thing called an ocular migraine, which looks so weird when you have it. I've had a few. Like, it's basically, it looks like a small patch of your vision is crawling, like literally crawling, like ants crawling on it. And it can sometimes spreads out across your whole field of vision. And it looks super weird, and it freaks you out the first time it happens to you, because you feel like you're going blind. But maybe, like, there are things like that that occasionally happen to people, and that gets interpreted as being whatever, a black triangle flying overhead. So, you know, the commonalities are certainly things that we should look at.
I agree, and I wouldn't even discount that possibility of, I mean, I might invoke slightly more fruity language than you, psychic projection of some form, like an image that's projected from inside the brain or inside the, you know, actual cognitive matrix. Because, you know, we are very subtle electrochemical biofactories, and, you know, little changes and tweaks in that can alter perception. But I actually think that in of itself is a fascinating corridor to dig into, which is actually kind of like the leapfrog into what I initially got interested in, which was, you know, novel effects in consciousness and non-locality, and whether or not these types of effects are actionable. And, you know, I find it fascinating, because there are a lot of instances, and to be honest, my own experiences actually draw a lot from that. This kind of like subtle non-local interaction with something that respond to a request. So to be completely open about it, I was, and there's a bit of a backstory behind this as to why I decided it was rational to be in my back garden, getting into a calm meditative state and projecting an intention that I wanted to be seeing something or something to turn up, because, you know, that's not exactly a normal set of behaviors. But there was a bit of a justification in my own personal, like, you know, kind of life journey as to why I was doing that. And I got a series of orange orbs of light fly across the sky, three of them, stop on a dime above the roof of my house, very high up, begin to descend down, like weaving in between each other. They then froze about 3 feet above the roof of my house. They were like these pale, slightly transparent pastel orange orbs, about basketball sized. And they stayed frozen over the roof of my house for a few seconds. Then they started this maneuvering again and started weaving around each other. Went over to my neighbor's garden over there and froze. And I was just staring gobsmacked again. No intelligent thoughts whatsoever. I couldn't actually believe what I was witnessing. And then they started this motion again and went up and up and up into the sky until they disappeared. Now, you know, no one was there to witness this. Mm. It could be, and I haven't dismissed this, because meditation and meditative techniques are ways of changing your electrochemical balance. Like, there is a perceptual change and a perceptual shift. So, you know, are they real? The Buddhists call that tulpas, the idea of a psychic projection, something that you almost coax into existence within your own subjective experience. And maybe someone else wouldn't be able to see it if they were sitting right next to you, but you can see it. But that, to me, actually does speak to a very deep level of consciousness that still needs to be explored. Like, what exactly is that, if that is the explanation? Yeah. I mean, I'm sorry, I'm kind of rambling, but like that, my experiences really did
mentally
shift how I view things. And it's, you know, I had video, man, I really do, but...
Oh, yeah, no, that's the thing, isn't it, though?
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's... yeah, and I know there's... This is something that comes up in ufology a lot, is like the individual experience. Is it unique to the individual? Or is it something that's perhaps an interaction between the individual and something else, another entity? I know Gary Nolan has talked a bit about this, and he's done some research, I think, on this. This was the caudate pulmon, something like the,
something like that,
the part of
the plenum or something like that. Yeah,
something like that. Let's call it the caudate something. That part of the brain, the CP, he says is bigger in certain people, has more connections between these two parts of the brain. And I think he thought at first that this was the result of an encounter. But then he seems to be moving towards it's causing the encounters.
A family lineage or, you know.
And that raises the idea that there's almost like a special section of humanity which is more ideally suited to having these types of experiences, which I think is obviously as an interesting idea, but doesn't have like great evidence other than this little study of Gary's. But it's also very compelling, I think, to people who have had experiences. I know it's a difficult thing to talk about because I do mention this a bit in my book, because there's like people want their experiences to be validated. There's also other cognitive biases that people have, and one is that people want to feel unique. And I think a lot of people like the idea that they might have a special brain that can detect aliens. There's nothing wrong with that. If I thought that I had a special brain that could detect aliens, I would be like, you know, yeah, this is awesome. But I think perhaps they're being, you know, not misled exactly, but given false hope there, that there's an explanation. It kind of reminds me of the Morgellons people. It's like people are trying to explain what's happening. You know, people in Morgellons, they have an experience. For them, it was like an illness.
Yeah.
And the doctors couldn't explain it. Mainstream science couldn't explain it. So they go out into the world looking for explanations. And then someone comes along and says, yeah, here's this fiber disease called Morgellons that explains everything that happened to you. And they're like, yeah, that's great. You've explained it all. And people who have had experiences are looking for explanations. And I think a lot of people who have had these experiences recognize that their experience doesn't seem to entirely have been a real physical thing because other people didn't see it. You know, perhaps they were in a town or something, like you probably got houses nearby you, and you know, did anybody else, I assume no one else reported it.
It was about 10 at night and I was alone, you know.
Yeah, but that would be the thing that makes something be a physical thing unambiguously is multiple people see it. Like you think of the Phoenix lights, lots of people saw the Phoenix lights, we have video of them, we know that there were lights in the sky at that time. Your thing, we don't know if it was, you know, some kind of your internal subjective perception of something that wasn't physically there, or was it something that was physically there that you perceived accurately or perceived inaccurately? There's a number of possibilities, and it's so frustrating for you and for anybody else talking about these subjects that you can't really get some kind of determination.
I think you do have to be cautious with kind of assigning a level of like special category to people as if they have a special brain, because that can go down some troublesome pathways as it has in history before.
Indeed, yes.
I think that at the same time, like, you know, I noticed your language using the brain to detect aliens. It's quite dismissive of the idea, whereas I would invoke things like, well, let's look at, you know, modern science and modern biophysics, the Hameroff-Penrose objective reduction theory, these types of ideas about quantum effects in the human body.
Yeah.
Onto microtubule fluctuations in the human body, inside the CNS, inside the neurons, and how it seems to be communicating in some form, which can be attributed to non-locality or seems to exhibit quantum effects on these types of biophysical levels. So I think that it's more akin to the whole generator-receiver debate in consciousness. Are we a complex neuromatrix and that's what's giving us our ability to be self-aware? Or is it a refined antenna and it's picking up on something that's within this reality that we're actually condensing and kind of propagating and allowing to express itself in a strong way? And there's still no good argument for or against either. There's, you know, the consciousness debate.
Yeah.
It's the big one. And I just think that in terms of invoking, like, you know, signal styles of consciousness, this is like the idea of saying we're all strong on a network as biological quantum computers of sorts. Now, we know that we're piezoelectric. We're naturally electrically conductive. We produce electromagnetism. Our heart produces an electromagnetic field. Brain produces an electromagnetic field. We're immersed in electromagnetism. And so our phones, our technologies, they can piggyback on these invisible lines. Why can't we? We're more sophisticated than an iPhone. Our brain is far more sophisticated than our technology. So I would say that it's actually more likely that we can use methods of conscious alteration And I'll just finish by saying that I think that instead of saying that there's special people, I think it's more about, are you working it out? Like, are you doing sit-ups in the morning? If not, well, you're not going to have a nice tight chest. If you're actually attempting to grow your conscious abilities, meditation and these different practices, maybe like a muscle, it can start to be flexed. And our society is channeled into a very specific corridor of conscious exploration. In fact, to the point where things are illegal in just exploring your unconscious state. A mushroom growing out of the ground that changes your perception, you're not allowed to take it. So we're channeled into quite restricted, narrow corridors. And I think maybe that has an effect on what we see and perceive. And so, yeah, there's outliers, people who meditate, people who do these things, and then they see stuff. But most people don't, because we're all on the same status quo consensus of what reality is meant to be. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. Like, you know, there's the whole idea of the psychonaut, the people who kind of explore the inner universe rather than the outer universe. And some of that with psychedelic drugs, some of that just with meditation techniques. And I wouldn't say there's nothing to it, but, you know, it's difficult to demonstrate that there is some kind of objective inner universe. We're in this kind of a multiple layer thing there, an objective, it's your subjective reality, but is it objective? Like, but, you know, you talk about things like electromagnetism. Can we do experiments on that? You know, the quantum stuff, can we do stuff that will disrupt?
Random number test generators where they've changed the sequence in ways that seems to be completely outside of probability.
Yeah. And that's an interesting thing, because it's highly contentious, because what they actually do doesn't seem like it makes any sense whatsoever. You have to be kind of altering the entire universe.
Maybe you are,
but like that would be pretty amazing.
You come from the stardust, born at the beginning of all things.
It's like all they've been able to demonstrate is in tests which are disputed, is that over like millions of trials, there's a small drift in a certain direction. The stuff like remote viewing doesn't really get very good results in general. It's these things. There's lots of studies which I think are somewhat dubious in their methodology and in their interpretation. But I wouldn't be opposed to it. I when I was young, I used to love the idea of, like, essentially psychic powers.
Yeah.
I mentioned somewhere, like, I read the story, The Incredible Tale of Henry Sugar, which there's a new movie out, or is it maybe a series, but there's a new thing out on this Roald Dahl story. And this is about a guy who taught himself basically to read cards.
All right.
And it would be that level of, manipulation of reality. I found that very compelling. And, I really, kind of believed it for a while as a youngster, as a teenager at the time.
Yeah.
I don't really believe it's possible now, but it would be awesome if it was. And I wouldn't be trying to fight it if people brought out evidence. But, I think the actual standard of evidence needs to be a bit more than just correlations between subjective experiences.
Well, it's interesting, in terms of, like, how do we evidence the subjective realms, the imaginary realms, like these, how do we produce reliable results or quantify it as something real? Well, I would say that everything surrounding you right now, including the clothes that you're wearing and the laptops that we're speaking through, every single thing that underpins humanity as this kind of innovator species comes from the same origin point. And the same origin point is the monkey mind and a strange non-physical dimensional space called the imagination that doesn't seem to have any restrictions in time, and things can be created instantly inside it. And we draw from that space that doesn't exist and create everything that exists in our civilization. So I would say that is pretty good evidence for it being all in something we're paying attention to.
Can you demonstrate that you need some kind of inner quantum weirdness to your consciousness to actually create things? I mean, what if consciousness arose in a more mechanistic manner? Which essentially a lot of people think it is a mechanistic thing, and we don't have these interactions with quantum microtubules. We just have a big old neural network in our heads that's creating this idea of consciousness. Now, can you demonstrate that a mechanistic biology would not be able to create the things that we create?
No, but I mean, it certainly speaks to a level of information that is very difficult to kind of comprehend, especially if you kind of take it down to like, you know, like the baseline levels of atoms and electrons and protons coalescing over time, over billions of years, the universe expands out and turns into galaxies and planets. And then on that planet, these different types of life develops. And then from that, one of these life forms propagates into this kind of form that can have a conversation about the actual, the kind of like premise of being alive. And that to me, whether it's neurologically embedded or fundamental to the framework, is a mystery still. Because I mean, we don't I mean, there's a good example of this actually. The principles that make up what is considered to be modern day philosophy of rationalism and material reductionism, right? So the philosophy which gives us kind of permission to deny the invisible world. Do you know who founded the modern day principles of materialism and rationalism?
Things of a few people, but you tell me.
Well, it's considered to be René Descartes.
Yeah, I was going to go with that, but I was thinking perhaps of like Plato.
Well, that's more into kind of like I'm talking about like scientific modernity. So like
okay, right, yeah, yeah. So Descartes, yeah,
it's kind of like, you know, the father of modern
Cartesian rationalism.
Yes. Do you know how he founded it?
Nope.
He was inspired to think up these principles through an interaction with what he believed to be an angel.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah,
you know, Newton was an alchemist, and
but this is my point. In a
cult alchemist,
yeah, in a fever dream, he had an angel come to him, and like in so many words, it said like, if you want to understand the universe, you have to think in terms of measurement and number. Yeah. And I just think it's a bit ironic because, you know, material reductionism and modern day rationalism are used as methods to debunk the so-called paranormal, but then you have these kind of interactions underpinning,
right?
Like, you know, René Descartes, but Einstein and Newton and Isaac, you know, they all have, all of the greatest minds in science, the real pioneers and titans, they all pay homage to some spiritual mystery, some intelligence, nature, something conscious, a godhead of some form. So I kind of think if we're going to go with scientific methods, we should probably appreciate the fact that the pioneers saw a real inherent mystery that can't be explained.
Sure, but what that mystery is how does the brain work? And I think, you know, this is something that we get ideas in the shower. Does that mean that the shower is causing our ideas, or is it just simply that they're arising out of you know, the subconscious workings of the brain? Like, your conscious brain isn't really what solves problems. Like, when I'm talking to you, I don't think about what I'm going to say next. It just comes out. It just flows out. When people, you know, get what they call downloads, it seems like someone's supplying them information, but is it just their own brain creating this information? You know, Tim Taylor, this scientist who went with Diana Pasulka and Gary Nolan on the In American Cosmic, you know, he describes this thing. You know, he gets his ideas basically by meditating in a certain way, and then he gets what he calls a download. He views that as coming from somewhere else, but, you know, again, you got this issue of can you demonstrate that it's coming from somewhere else, or is it just your brain thinking of stuff? I think of things all the time that are fairly interesting and novel, and I solve problems in ways that seem like a flash of inspiration. But is this flash of inspiration just simply the way the brain works, the mechanistic brain works, or does it mean that there's something else? Well, so I think it's difficult to make that connection.
I agree, but we're a symptom of nature. It's like finding the origin point for intellect. Like, where does it arise? I mean, you know, the fact that nature itself can knit the genomes together over such large expanses of time to create things like human beings. It's like, well, there's an intellect there, surely, that's kind of allowing this to then develop into what becomes the complex neural structure, the complex sensors of...
Is there, though? I mean, is it evolution and natural selection? I mean,
that's... Are you looking at it as what, billiard balls?
Well, no, I'm looking at it as the emergence of complex self-replicating structures over time, given a vast amount of time and space.
Well, why does the universe have a preference towards order over chaos? Why? Especially when...
It doesn't really. It arises occasionally, like crystals will crystallize in certain forms just because of the underlying physics of things. But, you know, I guess you could say the universe is well-formed in that we have little stars everywhere, but we don't have very much life that we can tell exists.
It's formed on a level of like geometric mathematical perfection that's relatively
not expensive. Really, I mean, the genome is mostly junk.
But we don't actually know what that means yet. Maybe.
It's extremely messy, the genome.
Relatively, you know, gray area.
And there's lots of leftovers. I mean, like, is the human body really the best well-designed thing? I mean, look at our eyes. The sensors in our eyes face backwards because they evolved that way. It works fine, but it would be way better if we had the sensors facing forwards. We have, like, crap like our appendix that doesn't really do anything useful. And we have various parts of the body that need removing.
Hadron colliders and go to the, maybe there's trade-offs, you know, like you can't have this happen.
Well, yeah, but like why do we need to go to the bathroom? I mean, it's like, seems like such an unnecessary thing. If we had some kind of something creating a thing, why do they create such crap bodies that like die after so many years? Why am I feeling ill right now because of because I'm getting old. It's like, you know, you could argue that there might be something helping with human evolution, but it seems like a lot of weird choices were made.
Well, I mean, like, you could almost argue that we're in the process of actually delivering that longer lasting life form called artificial. I mean, we do seem to be, and some people in the technology sector would argue that is exactly what we're doing, that this is the cocoon, this is the next step of nature, this is the next evolutionary leap, and that we're going to essentially move into a kind of like cyborg fusion where we can extend our lifetime. So like, it's a
drawing
up of a plan. I mean, if you think about it in terms of like from the beginnings of time to now, the universe has been, in essence, unfolding into more complicated layers, whilst also, weirdly enough, breaking down through entropy. So there's like a contradiction of the laws of thermodynamics, because you've got a breaking down of a system and a cooling down of a system, whilst at least observable in our environment, complexity and novelty and increases in things happening, events happening, at least in our little section of space-time, that's occurring. So it's interesting to me, if you look at us right now, we're maybe just like the Mark One of like getting a vehicle to explore the universe. Like Carl Sagan said, you know, we're the way for the universe to know itself. Maybe we're the app through which this intellect explores. And like you said, we die, we have to go to the toilet. Well, maybe there's another iteration coming, and it doesn't look like it's far down the line, to be honest. It looks like it's coming quick.
No, I agree. I don't think it's necessarily going to be an extension of humans, and we're not really going to be like, you know, these, you know, people talk about things like Childhood's End, like stories like that, where humanity essentially ascends to the next level. Yeah, I think essentially it's going to be humanity is going to end, and artificial life is going to proceed in the longer term. Not in our lifetimes probably, but I think that's probably where things are going. I think, you know, there's a big issue in the philosophy of consciousness and the science of consciousness, is like, where is your consciousness and can you transfer it from one thing to another? And if you're transferring it, are you actually transferring it, or you're just making a copy of it? If you upload your consciousness to the cloud, do you die? And then there's a soulless entity that continues on without you. Like, there, you know, there's all these like philosophical questions that I think are fun to think about, but it's, to some degree, like coming real. Like, we artificial intelligence in our lifetimes is going to be a lot more intelligent than us, without microtubules. Probably without quantum computing. It's just going to be these giant server farms that will be more intelligent than people, and they probably, you know, are more intelligent than most people. If you take, like, you know, ChatGPT for example, when you interact with it, it's you interacting with a small fragment of it. If you just put the entire thing on you know, being intelligent, you would get something that was vastly more intelligent than people. It would have gaps in its knowledge, obviously, because it doesn't have the same subjective experiences as humans. But, you know, from all intents and purposes, it would be better at most things than most people.
We're entering into a gray area with AI.
Indeed. Interesting times.
Really interesting times. The Confucius curse seems to be very much upon our heads in this lifetime, because we're in a very like kind of geopolitically unstable time and like socially unstable time, lots of divides in different areas. And then technology and AI, I mean, like, it wasn't like a few years ago, no one was really thinking about AI. I mean, everyone knew it, but nobody was thinking about it. Now, most people have GPT open on a tab. And it's just like normal, you know, it's just normal.
I do. I've got one ChatGPT, and I've got the Copilot, the GitHub Copilot for writing code, because it's a lot faster to just type in a comment and have it fill in the complicated code than it is to actually try to remember everything to type in. So robots are replacing us, but they've been doing that for a long time. I mean, automation has been for a long time, but automating the intellectual processes is a different kettle of fish than
This is what my friend Mikai, who's been trying to warn industry about this kind of stuff for a long time, calls hyper automation, because it's now becoming kind of like an asymptotic curve. It's just getting, you know, compounding on itself and getting faster and faster in innovation. And it's a weird one, man. I mean, I'm really interested in AI, but I definitely see how it could become a very scary reality for us in the near future.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, yeah. Elon Musk and a few of the others who are, like, you know, at the spearhead of looking at it, genuinely think we're only a couple of years away from AGI. And I don't know where I sit on that, but if that's true, I mean, AGI actually, you know, theoretically, because this is all still theory, if an AGI actually was created in the next couple of years, I don't think we could predict the next 5 or 10.
No, I mean, what's it going to do? I mean, artificial intelligence is being used quite a lot in industry already, and it's accelerating things, because you can do things like, you know, like material science, especially, you know, some things that take humans like forever to do, and, you know, they make mistakes and everything. It can just do it, like, and, you know, the limits to AGI. I mean, it's like AGI is one thing, but that's another thing. That's like an entirely different thing. That's literally impossible. You know, if you think of AGI, you know, artificial general intelligence. That's just basically what people refer to when they say something that can replicate a human.
Yeah.
But, you know, replicating a human is just one tiny little dot on the line, which we've already passed in different directions. We haven't got something that exactly replicates it, but we've got things that are way better in certain directions, and we're going to be bypassing that in all directions. So it's going to be, it already is revolutionary for industry. And I think a lot of people who would disagree with that just simply, yeah, they're just not really following what's going on. Yeah, there are older people who don't really understand what's actually happening, but it's a revolution.
No, it's still like quite a bit of knee-jerk reaction. I think people are afraid of it and want to kind of undermine its importance, because it's really bloody scary, actually, when you think. I mean, all of our, you know, popular science fiction is Blade Runner and Terminator and Matrix. And, you know, have you seen the Sora, OpenAI Sora, that's been announced now? I mean, you know, you want to talk about UFO videos and trying to debunk or trying to confirm, like, good luck now. We're literally in a post-consensus reality where
It makes it easier for people making fake videos, but people could always make really compelling fake videos before, you know, with the movie technology that we had. Excuse me. But yeah, it's definitely like a whole new kettle of fish. But I think it also introduces new tools. Mm-hmm. There's going to be new ways of analyzing UFO videos. And I'm sure, like, people like Arrow are looking into using artificial intelligence. They mentioned it years ago, before it was even ChatGPT even came out. They mentioned patterns of life analysis using artificial intelligence. So that might help filter a lot of the signal from the noise with UFOs. It might even lead to a real discovery.
I hope so. I think it might. I think it could actually potentially be a real tool, a real asset to leverage in analyzing data and, you know, innovatory ways to leverage technology and sensor fusion. So who knows, maybe it will. And I kind of get, you know, Mick, I get the impression that you are perfectly willing to actually acknowledge a real anomaly. I feel like your bar is set pretty high, maybe a little bit too high in my personal opinion.
Maybe.
I think you're not necessarily steadfast in your idea that there's no possibility that this could be real, and you're open.
No, I'd love it to be real. Love it to be real.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be really, really interesting. The world would be more interesting. The world's pretty interesting as it is, so either way, I'd be fine. But, you know, that whole new kettle of fish for us to look at. And also, like, the stuff that I do is basically solving puzzles. Like, you know, what is that thing that people saw in the sky? If it turns out aliens are real, that's not going to change. It doesn't mean that every single thing you see in the sky is explained by our you know, our visitors from Zeta Reticula. There's going to be things that won't be explained by them, and that will need explaining too. Of course, everyone's going to be very distracted by the real non-human intelligence for a while. But yeah, there's still going to be things in the sky to analyze, and so I'll still have my little hobby to do. Plus, I'll have aliens, so it'll be like win-win.
Before we wind down, one last thing I'd like to get, because I think it's fair to say you probably experience a decent brunt of this. I've experienced it, which I find interesting, because I'm sure as people can tell from this conversation, I'm more on the let's try and bring Mick over to slightly more believing side of things. So I'm one of the community. I'm an experiencer. I'm someone who's actually interested in trying to get some transparency on this subject. But I've experienced some hate online and some targeted harassment and people that don't feel like I'm toeing with the narrative enough or not supporting some of the key players enough. So I wouldn't mind getting your opinion on, because you've been in the game for quite a while. You've probably seen a shift. I feel like I've seen a shift just over the last few years in terms of kind of like the animosity and the radicalism online with this particular subject. So I wouldn't mind kind of getting your thoughts on how you feel the online kind of social media space and this new era of people interested in this subject.
I think, free exchange of ideas is very useful. A lot of the work I do relies upon collaboration with other people. And bouncing things off other people and getting their input on it. And sometimes they solve the whole thing without me. And, I just like report on it. So I think, having discussion forums is great. But, a lot of what you see online, it kind of devolves a bit into camps of people who are just kind of fighting one thing versus the other. Have you ever looked at things like Flat Earth, not to compare Flat Earth to UFOs, but just in terms of communities within Flat Earth, that's that ridiculously idiotic community. And it's basically people who claim to believe in Flat Earth, they make some claim, and then people who don't believe in Flat Earth, which is most people, call them stupid, and then it goes back and forth, and that's all it is. No one's really doing anything to progress things. And there's a little bit of that in ufology, in that, if I solve a case, like say I discover something is a balloon or something like that, then people will just say, oh, Mickey, just cherry picking, and you're to these easy cases, what about the other cases? And just because you solve that case, it doesn't mean all the other cases are being solved. So you get this kind of knee-jerk reaction, which is just to oppose whatever I did regardless of what it actually is. And then I think you get these animosity between various camps, even within the community. I don't know why that happens, but I guess why it's happening is just a natural way people are. People form into tribes, and then they defend their turf, and then they get feuds between the other people because of imagined slights or even real slights, and then you get these disagreements, and then people end up like hating each other, which I think is very unfortunate. I try to stay out of that, like the drama aspect of online, within ufology. And I think ufology especially has an issue with it because passions do run a lot higher within ufologies because of people who have had their own experiences. It gives them a very deep felt, skin in the game. Like, and if someone seems to be debunking something, it can be seen as a personal attack. So I can understand where people will be pushing back against what they perceive as being debunkers. Do I consider myself an investigator and not a debunker? It's unfortunate, I think, that things have got messy, but I think it's inevitable. If you look at, like Taylor Swift fans, you probably get like schisms within those groups. I was watching a documentary a few days ago about people who investigate true crime. And there was one particular thing they were investigating, a hiker who went missing on the Appalachian Trail. And there was a Facebook group, and the woman who was running it like got into a big dispute with another one who left and set up their own group. And then they were all fighting amongst each other. It's just a natural human thing. It just happens amongst people. It's inevitable. It's unfortunate. But I don't think you can really get around it, especially when people get emotionally and intellectually and sometimes financially invested in these topics.
I personally think there's just no easy answers right now. And maybe we will actually get a little bit of a clearer vision as things progress, as technology progresses, as our models change for reality, as things start to come into clearer focus. But either way, I think there's always going to be people who, truly believe that something is going on. There's going to be people that have their doubts, and there's going to be people that want to pick it apart like yourself. And I don't think there's a problem with that. So
I wouldn't say I want to pick it apart. I want to figure out what's going on. I suppose you could call it picking it apart, but I'm not.
I didn't mean any negative connotations to that. I genuinely just meant, investigating, looking at it, picking it.
I want to analyze it. I enjoy the aspect of it, and I recognize the problems, you know, with experiences and communication with experiences, and how I can come across sometimes. And it's unfortunate, and I try to do better than that. And this is something that goes back all the way back to my Morgellons days. You've got to be sensitive to the other person. You've got to try to understand where they're coming from. Even if you think that they are wrong or mistaken or even delusional, you know, like say with some of the people in the Morgellons community, they had, you know, full on delusions. You've got to still, if you want to make any progress, you've got to treat people with respect.
Yeah.
And that's something that I think, you know, we should do within the UFO community. And it doesn't mean we have to agree with everybody, but we can politely disagree and then constructively try to resolve those disagreements.
It's important and it's complicated and people get, you know, hot over it. But at the same time, I do think that there is an endearing mystery here. I appreciate you taking time to come and speak to me about it.
Well, thank you, Jay. Thank you for having me on. I know like not everyone would want you to have me on, and so I appreciate you doing that. And thank you for a very interesting and wide-ranging conversation.